Blog Talk Radio.
This is Chief for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, welcome to Chief for Yourself. Great to have you with us, wherever you happen to be in the world at this moment. Our topic on today's program is depression. The World Health Organization named depression the number one cause of ill health and disability worldwide, with more than 300 million people affected. And in fact, more than one-sixth of Americans take psychiatric medication, usually an antidepressant, to deal with their depression. Our guest today is going to be telling us about a program that uses mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, or MBCT for short, to bring relief to chronic sufferers of depression. Dr. Stuart Eisendroth is the author of When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. Dr. Eisendroth, not to sound like movie trailer guy, but in a world where so many people suffer from depression, what makes a medical doctor want to branch out from his standard practice and then write a book about contemplative ways to approach depression?
Well, my thinking going into the book was I had experience both with depression myself and with mindfulness. And as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was developed, I saw that it was a very powerful tool for helping people. And as you mentioned, many people start out their treatment for depression with antidepressants. But the figures on that are not that in producing of enthusiasm. For example, if you take people and give them 12 weeks of treatment with a full dose of antidepressants, only 30% will have fully recovered. If you give them a second antidepressant after the first one, only a total of 50% will have recovered. So that means after two antidepressant trials, only 50% are recovered, and 50% then are not fully recovered. And at our depression center at UCSF, we wanted to develop a strategy for offering people something other than more medication that could empower people to be to get more recovery, more improvement, and more remission of depression after they had already tried antidepressants.
I'm curious as to what constitutes a full recovery. Is it just a matter of a certain length of time with no episodes? How is that determined?
Well, full recovery in our field means that they have virtually no symptoms of depression. We use an instrument to score how many symptoms a person has, and it means that they have either zero or a very low level of symptoms, and then that persists for a certain period of time. So that's how we measure that.
And I'm curious as to whether you felt any risk when you went in this direction, because there are people who look askance at bringing these types of protocols into a medical practice. Maybe even some of your peers felt that way. What was the reaction?
Our peers generally were enthusiastic. Mindfulness has been growing in interest over the past 30 years. And I think people were receptive to it because they knew that we had 50% of people who weren't recovering completely, and they wanted to develop strategies as well. So I'd say it's moved well into the mainstream of different tools that people can use to enhance their recovery.
So let's unpack this. What exactly is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy? It's a mouthful. We call it MBCT. Describe it for us.
Well, it's a blend of mindfulness meditation, which is really started as an ancient Buddhist technique 2,500 years ago to train people to focus their attention in certain ways. And it's matched with some concepts from cognitive behavior therapy. So people blend those two things together, and you get a package of exercises, meditations, and some concepts from cognitive therapy that help people to get better and help them to combat things like negative thoughts, which are very common in depression, like things like I'm not a good person, or I'll fail at whatever I try, or I won't be good enough, or I won't be successful. So those kinds of negative thoughts are very common. And in fact, we know the 30 most common negative thoughts that people have. And for any one person, they have a specific number of those for themselves. Not everybody has all 30, but usually people who are depressed have their own top 10 negative thoughts, sort of a Letterman's list of the top 10 that they suffer from. And in mindfulness cognitive therapy, they learn that those thoughts are just that, thoughts, and not facts.
And I know you've had your own experiences with depression, as I have had. What was your life like when you were experiencing that? How were you functioning?
Well, I was fortunately always able to function, but it was a pretty difficult period. And that it actually led me to some of my seeking out mindfulness, because when I was depressed, I had a lot of guilty thoughts that occurred to me, and I was in actually psychoanalysis at that time, and that involved trying to dig up the origins of those guilty thoughts. So it would be learning how, what did I do in my childhood that produced that kind of guilt? And only later did I learn and realize that those guilty thoughts are just thoughts. They're not facts. It doesn't mean I did anything worthy of guilt. Guilt is really a symptom of depression. So when you're feeling guilty, it's not everyone, but many people have thoughts of guilt, and it's a symptom, just like if you have pneumonia, an elevated body temperature is a symptom of it. So people have guilty thoughts or other negative thoughts that are symptoms, and those symptoms, unfortunately, cycle back and worsen depression, because if you have the thought, I'm a bad person, or I won't succeed, that's going to make you feel more depressed. And so what mindfulness-based cognitive therapy does is break up that cycle. So when you have a thought, you can recognize it as a thought, a mental event, and you don't have to buy into it. I liken it to walking down a street in a town where there's shops along the street, and you see different negative thoughts in the store windows. If you're depressed, there's a tendency to go into the store and buy those thoughts and make them your own. But if you have a mindfulness approach, you can walk down the street and notice the thoughts, but you don't have to buy them. The thoughts are still there, but you don't have to buy those thoughts.
Yeah, and there's an element, I guess, of spirituality in this too, because it's the eternal I am. And when you say I am depressed, you're kind of taking ownership. You're making that who you are. Is it simplistic to say don't take ownership of it, rather look at it, just notice it? Is that what we're doing here?
That's exactly right. When you say something like, I'm a bad person, or I'm no good, or I'm a failure, what you're really saying is, I have the thought I'm a failure. I have the thought I'm a bad person. And once you reframe it like that, it allows you to observe it. What we call, you decenter from that thought, and you realize it's just a thought.
Our guest on The Chi for Yourself is Dr. Stuart Eisendrath, author of When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. I want to, just for a moment, go back to when you experienced your own depression. I'm wondering, whether that experience brings more compassion to your practice. Does it have an effect on how you practice day to day?
Oh, absolutely. It's it made me very sensitive to people who are suffering from depression because I'd been there myself. So that was a great stimulus for me to get in the field of working on depression. And actually, I founded the UCSF Depression Center as part of my quest to really develop an organized approach to helping people who were depressed experience much less suffering, that they could learn a technique that they could take with them wherever they are, both as I had, but for them to learn these empowering techniques and have an approach that they could use whenever they needed it.
MBCT not only incorporates a wide range of the formal practices, things like body scan and mindful stretching and yoga and silent meditation, but it also teaches patients to integrate mindfulness into their everyday activities, things like practicing mindful eating. That's, I mean, you could do this in almost any phase of your day, couldn't you?
Absolutely. That's an extremely good point. There's two types of mindfulness, really. I mean, one is basically a discrete period of time where you focus your attention on something, like the body and the body scan, or the breath. And you may do it for a period of time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes. But what you're also describing is what we call dispositional mindfulness, where you apply mindfulness in your everyday life. While you're walking down the street, you notice the sensations in your feet, in your legs, or when you're chopping carrots for dinner, you notice what the sensations are like as you're chopping. And so you can apply mindfulness. I like to think of mindfulness as being like a spotlight that you shine on something. You select what you shine it on, but you pay very close attention to it. And you can choose what you're going to focus on. And you'll notice when you do that, your mind tends to wander. And many people think, well, my mind wanders. I must not be doing this right. But actually, mind wandering is normal, and it's part of the common human experience. In mindfulness, the real skill is noticing that your mind has wandered, and then gently and kindly escorting the attention back to your object of attention, the breath or the body or whatever you're focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have your own meditation practice, don't you? I mean, you have your own practice, I guess, day to day, or however you do?
Oh, yes, certainly. I practice every day.
Now, do you also have a yoga practice?
Not so much. I do some yoga occasionally, but and yoga is meditative and it bears a lot of similarity to it, but I do some other types of meditation besides yoga. I don't do as much yoga as perhaps I should, but it isn't something that I've focused on myself.
Getting back to some of the numbers, 350 million people around the world suffering from depression, and nearly a million suicides every year. Getting properly diagnosed is the first step for healing before patients get to the real downward spiral. What is the importance, or what is the definition of a proper diagnosis?
Well, a proper diagnosis is when a clinician finds that the person has, according to most standards, a set of symptoms that are typical of depression, and those are things like sad mood, changes in appetite, either increase or decrease, sleep disorders, either too much or too little, agitation or slowing of the body, depressive thoughts, suicidality, and trouble making decisions. There's a variety of these symptoms when they're present signify a person having depression. Usually we think of if the person has five or more such symptoms that they meet the criteria for making a diagnosis of depression.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, too, about societal pressures, the news, the pressure to make a living. How much of an influence do you think those are having on the depression numbers?
Well, those are definitely a factor. But basically, stress is very much related to depression, and stress can take many forms. I mean, it can take the form of having a fire in your, as we're having in Northern California right now, fires that stress people, or the trauma of losing your home to a fire, or other kinds of traumatic events, or everyday stresses, that the tensions you can read about in the newspaper every day. Those are all stresses that can affect a person. And what we found is that genetically, some people have genes that help prevent them from developing depression when they're stressed, and whereas some other people have a set of genes that actually predispose them to have depression when they're stressed. So it's a combination of biology and psychological stress that come together and affect the person.
If genes do come into play, is that something that can be in the family?
Absolutely. There's definitely a family pattern of inheritance. So if one person in the family is depressed, others in the family are more likely to develop depression. Not all, because the offspring, for example, are getting genes from somebody else. So there may be a mixture of genes, but there's a definite propensity for depression if a person has depression in their family history.
A certain television commercial, and I won't mention the name of the product, but it paints a very pretty picture of a couple, middle-aged or maybe a little older, walking in a field and just kind of enjoying life, and it's a commercial for an antidepressant, but it warns that antidepressant medicines of this type could increase suicidal thoughts or actions in some children, teenagers, or young adults in the first few months of treatment. What is this doing to society? I mean, people want these things. They want to feel better. They want to be like the people on TV, but with so many dangerous side effects, how should they approach this?
Well, that's right. Some of those commercials, there's a good and bad to them. They may make people more aware of the possibility of depression, but when they paint such a rosy picture, as we talked about earlier in this session, only 50% of people are going to develop a complete remission after two or more antidepressant trials. So 50% of people aren't going to be bouncing down the field, you know, happy as can be. They're going to continue to suffer significant depression. And that's important for people to know, so that if they don't fully recover, they shouldn't take it as a sign of weakness or as a personal failure. It's really a limitation of those medications. But as I said, the medications can be very helpful and can be life-saving, but there's side effects and costs associated with the medications. And so we want to develop alternatives that people can use in addition to medication. And in addition, many people suffer from relapse of depression. Depression tends to be a recurrent illness. So if a person has one episode of depression over a 10-year period, they're likely to have another episode. And if they have two or more episodes of depression, they have a 90% chance of having another episode within 3 years. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is not only a treatment for people who are suffering from depression, but also it helps prevent relapse. And in a there was a major study of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for people who were fully recovered after they had had antidepressants. And they were divided then into two groups. One group continued their antidepressants for 2 years. The other group received mindfulness training and then were tapered over 8 weeks and then were tapered off their antidepressants. And they found that at the end of 2 years, almost there was a tendency for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy to actually be a bit better, but statistically they were the same. So that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was just as good as antidepressant medication in preventing relapse over a two-year period. So it's an alternative that people can use. If they don't want to be on medications, it's another option. I'm not advocating that people do this without discussing it, of course, with their prescriber, their doctor, but it is an alternative that's available.
What do you hope that readers will take away from this book?
Well, I hope readers will understand a bit more about depression, not take it as a personal failure, and learn some techniques that they can take with them wherever they go. And that meditation doesn't have to be sitting in a lotus position for 45 minutes. It can be something they can practice as they walk down the street, or they can practice in a brief meditation. In my book, we have a number of very brief meditations. For example, a 3-minute breathing space where people can do that almost wherever they are, sitting on a bus or in an airline terminal or wherever, or sitting at their desk at work. They can just do a 3-minute breathing space to help them come back to the present moment. And the present moment is really the key. That's really all we have. And if you can focus on the present moment, it has a natural antidepressant feeling, because in depression, you have a feeling that you've lost something, a job, a relationship, money, whatever it is. You feel as if you've lost something. And whereas in anxiety, you feel you're going to lose something. So you're thinking in the future a loss is going to take place. If you focus on the present moment, you let go of the past focus and let go of the future focus and just focus on what is present right now. And doing that as an antidepressant and anti-anxiety effect.
Your website is www.stuarteisendrath.com, and the book is When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression, from our guest, Dr. Stuart Eisendrath. Dr. Eisendrath, thank you so much for being with us today. I am totally on board with the ideas in this book. I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us, and I'll be watching for your work in the future, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'll link to Dr. Eisendrath's website at cheeforyourself.com, and while you're there, leave your email address in the little box provided at the top of the page. You'll get those Genulines blog posts with show information, guest dates, and starting times. They'll get to you in good time. So with that, we'll call it a day. Thank you so much for being with us today and for all of your likes and subs and support. Always appreciate it. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.